is, what do we lean on? We all lean on somebody or something. I'm going to read from Mark 6, 7 through 13. Then Jesus went around teaching from village to village, calling the twelve to him. He began to send them out two by two and gave them authority over impure spirits. These were his instructions. Take nothing for the journey except a staff, no bread, no bag, no money in your belts. Wear sandals, but not an extra shirt. Whenever you enter a home, stay there until you leave that town. And if any place will not welcome you or listen to you, leave that place and shake the dust off your feet as a testimony against them. They went out and preached that people should repent. They drove out many demons and anointed many sick people with oil and healed them. Certainly had God's blessing on the reading. A pastor of a small town church had a kitten. The kitten climbed up in a tree in his backyard and then was afraid to come down. The pastor coaxed the kitten, offered warm milk and treats, but the kitten just wouldn't come down. The tree wasn't sturdy enough to climb, and so the pastor decided that if he tied a rope to his car and onto the tree, he could bend the tree down and reach up and get the kitten. That's what he did. All the while checking his progress, he figured if he went just a little bit further and bent the tree just a little bit more, he could reach the kitten. And as he moved the car ahead further a little bit more, the rope broke and the tree went boing, and the kitten instantly sailed through the air out of sight. After much searching for the lost kitten without any success, the pastor prayed, "Lord, I commit this kitten to your keeping." And then he went about his business. A few days later, he was at the grocery store. He met up with one of his church members. He happened to notice a large bag of cat food in the member's cart. As he knew she was a cat hater, he asked her why she was buying cat food. "You won't believe this," she said. And the member went on to tell the pastor the story. It seems her little girl had been begging for a cat, but she had kept refusing. And after many requests for a cat by the little girl, she told her, "Well, if God gives you a cat, I'll let you keep it." So she relayed to the pastor. She said, "I was watching my child go out in the yard, get on her knees and ask God for a cat. And really, Pastor, you won't believe this, but I saw it with my own eyes. A little kitten suddenly came flying out of the blue sky with his paws spread out and landed right in front of her. So now, Pastor, we have a cat." Lord works in mysterious ways, that's for sure. What do we lean on? That's the title of the message. Much has been spoken and written in workshops about creating an independent lifestyle. Invest now so later you can live a lifestyle that you want when you retire in your golden years, whatever they are. Seniors are enticed with independent living at homes designed for the elderly folks at a cost of for sure. We are not autonomous beings. We were created to be dependent on each other. In the beginning, in Genesis 2:20, no matter how you read this story about the relationship between God and man was to cleave unto his wife, I see that as a relationship story. Right from the very beginning, we were designed to have relationships. I don't necessarily see this story just as what some people do. I see the story in Genesis, male and female, as two bookends, and their sexuality of LGBTQ community in between. So in case somebody was thinking about that, I that's how I see it, that story is not referring to, as some conservatives say, but it's about a relationship, no matter what, who you are or what you are. And these are what I consider to be bookends. We are family. We start out as family. The civilization has started out as family, tribes and clans and communities. We've gone to towns and cities and nations. And yes, it takes a village. Wealth is dependent upon this duality that spans out across. We know we have this working duality. Relationships within this duality work in various different ways. But no matter where you are in this world in which we live, whether you're poor or wealthy, or you are very intelligent, or you're not quite so, it doesn't matter. We are all interdependent in relationships. The question is, I will ask you, you tell me one thing in which you are not dependent on something or someone else. From the time you wake up to the time you go to bed, you tell me one thing that you're not dependent on something else. Anybody want to try? Just waking up is your internal body clock has to tell you to wake up. Everything you do, we rely on somebody else. Food on the shelves. I use this as one of my analogies. A little can of green beans that are on the shelf that are a dollar or 99 cents or whatever they are. It takes a lot of people to get that one can of green beans on that shelf. It's dependent on a lot of different people. It's dependent on people to grow the seed so you can plant the seed. It's the farmer who plants it, who cultivates it, who harvests it, who processes it, the trucks that haul it, and the people that stock it on the shelves. We don't necessarily think about it in them terms when we go to buy that 99-cent can of green beans. But there's a lot of people that are that we're dependent on getting that can there. We are dependent and we lean on many different things along the way. We depend on our governments of all kinds. As much as we kind of argue about our different ways of thinking, the right and the left, we still are dependent on government. We should be dependent on the church also, but I'll get to that in a minute. The floods down in the Carolinas. You hear story after story of people depending on one another and helping each other out. It seems that when disaster comes, that seems to be when the time when we want to come together. Otherwise, we seem to want to live our own lives. And I guess that's okay. I mean, I haven't met my neighbor up in the woods but a couple times. He kind of keeps to himself, him and his wife, and that's okay. We live in a, and I'm sure if something happened, there we would be work together. People helping people. We are interconnected. There is no singleness of thought or action. They're all connected. There is no difference when it comes in such disasters as we see. There's not racism in the sense that we see it. At least I hope not. There's not discrimination. We hope not. But you know, sometimes people take advantage of it in disasters. The question I want to ask here this morning is, did Jesus send the disciples out empty-handed? It appears to be that they weren't supposed to take nothing with them. They were to be led by the Spirit, and they were, the word is, given authority or power. Gave them power, and some texts it says power, and some it says given them authority, or some texts say power and authority. There are different stories within the Gospels. Not every one of them match up, and that's okay. I see that as just a different person's viewpoint, but they basically agree. The word I want to look at is power. What does that mean? What is power? Did Jesus simply lay his hands on them and say, hey, go out there and figure it out yourself? Let the Spirit guide you however you want? Or did he teach them along the way? Is power in the education and the knowledge in which you have? Teachers, we have teachers here who are teachers. They teach students so that they can think for themselves, so they are empowered by their education. We hear that term. You are empowered by your education. There is power in knowledge and understanding. What I think is that Jesus did not send them out empty-handed at all. The power in which he gave them was the ability to think and the knowledge and thereby to go out and do what they did. He didn't simply say, go out and have fun. I think in Matthew, Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount and thereon, there's a lot of things in there in which he would have educated the disciples to think differently. Love your neighbor as yourself, turn the other cheek, on and on and on and on. So behind this power that he gave the disciples was a great education. He educated the disciples and taught them in a way that they understood. Now for me, understanding something is as twofold. I can understand something simply because I'm told the sequence in doing something. I understand that there's a sequence. I must say I'm going to repair my truck. There's a sequence in which I'm going to do it. I don't necessarily have to understand the function of the motor or the engine in order to do it. But I think there's a difference between knowledge and understanding. I can have the understanding on how to do it, but do I really understand how the engine functions? How does it develop horsepower and torque? That's another whole aspect of it. And I think the disciples were taught in a way that they understood how God's power functioned. And they didn't just go out and say, well, if I do this, this, and this, this is going to happen. But I don't understand why. I think they understood a why and what Jesus taught them. They understood that there's a sequence of things to happen. They just didn't go out and lay their hands on somebody and hope for the best. There was a knowledge in which they had. We in the medical field, or those in the medical field, for years, and as far as I can remember, was we wanted to heal the body. That's what we were concerned about. We heal the body, which is important, don't get me wrong. But only lately is beginning to be a spirit, mind, and body connection. There's an understanding that the body and the mind and the soul or the spirit are all connected. And that the idea that if I heal the spirit or the mind, that the body will follow in suit. This is a kind of a new way. I can remember when chiropractors were considered to be quacks. Now it's considered to be something that a lot of people, as part of the healing process. Wholeness, holistic healings are coming back quite readily and a great speed. I think that Jesus taught the disciples how to heal the spirit and the soul and the mind. He worked that way down, and thus the body was healed. We tend to look at it and want to heal just the body. That's all we're concerned. If we heal the body, yada, 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 it will be okay. But there's a healing of the mind and the soul and the spirit that has to come too also if you want to be healed. And I thought, and again, I think Jesus taught in that way. There is a lot of things that are on the table that is considered to be New Age healing and New Age thought, which I think has been around for years and years and years. And we just have shoved it aside and said, here, take a pill. Everything will, you'll be all straightened out. Or we'll cut you open and we'll try to fix you. Not that they don't have a place. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying they don't have a place. They do. But holistic healing is you know, everything together. Auras and people that can look at, and I believe that Jesus could look at somebody and know the place where they were needed healing, and he could straighten out the light, whatever that means. I'm not sure all that, but I have read books about it. But I think that's where the healing started. It started from the spirit, and then it worked its way out. People who can read auras and see these type of things, they can see the spot by the colors. And they work and change that. I think that is something that Jesus taught his disciples how to do. It wasn't just magic. They just didn't go out and lay their hands on it and say, okay, abracadabra, you're healed. There was more involved in it. They understood this teaching, and they applied it. Power is the ability to know how and the whys and whatever what you're doing. Again, another example I wrote down was many of us know we can go out to our car, we turn the key on, we put it in gear, and we go down the road. But do we really know what it all takes to make that car drive down the road? Probably most of us don't. Never tore one apart, don't really know. And the whole mystery about a car and engines is horsepower and torque. There is no part that's called horsepower and torque, but that's the only thing that gets you down the road. And that is invisible. It's an invisible power in which the engine develops, and that's what pulls you down the road. All that contraption out there does is support horsepower and torque, which is invisible to see, which I think is a very good analogy to our spiritual life. What gets us down the road in life? It's our spiritualness, an unseen spiritual realm in which gets us down the road. I was going to look at some verses along the way and to kind of support this idea, but I'll kind of leave that up to you. You can look up the word power and try to see what I'm trying to say. It's the ability to understand, it's knowledge, it's education, it's the ability. Time and time again, you can replace that word in the Bible. Yes?
One translation calls it authority.
A what?
Authority.
Authority.
Instead of power. I mean, they translated it a little differently.
Yes.
I got four translations here.
So even authority fits in there too, because if I'm well educated and know how to do something, I have authority over whatever it is I'm working on. I can have the authority of working over the motor or the engine or a physician over a patient. There's a certain level of authority in which you have by your knowledge and your understanding. You apply it. Yes, there's many other things that happen along the way. You don't want to do it pridefully. You don't want to, you want to respect it. But it's, yes, authority comes with that.
He sent them two by two, giving them authority over the unclean spirits.
Yes, right. But in the application of authority and power and is the ability that they knew what they were doing. They just weren't haphazardly going out, I don't think, and doing. They had an understanding and a teaching. There's many books that are written, the idea of a secret knowledge of what Jesus taught Mary and a few people, that secret knowledge that is, as always, this elusive secret knowledge that we keep always looking for, or is talked about in the early beginning of the Christian church. I think sometimes, well, I'll leave that. That's another idea. But we are all connected. Corinthians 12, 4 to 11, which states, Paul's writing about the many different spirits that come, that the gifts of the Spirit, that they're all different for a different type of service, but yet, and they manifest themselves in various different ways, but yet they're all connected to one. There's one capitalized one. Not one in the singular, but one capitalized as a term that I say of all the infinite. One is, I haven't said this in a while, one is both singular and infinite. One can be singular as one, but one contains all the numbers that there are. So it's one is both singular and infinite at the same time. So when it's capitalized in the Bible, it's pointing towards an infinite God. It means an infinite idea or God. So that's, and many translations get that a little bit. They don't know where to put the capitalized one because for some reason they didn't seem to understand that principle in my estimate. But anyway, he goes on to use the analogy of a body. A body has a whole lot of parts to it, but yet it all works together. It's all interconnected. We are interconnected, whether you want to believe it or not. There is a spirit that moves amongst us and emanates us, and we are connected. It doesn't matter who you are or where you're at. Jonathan Edwards, who was a philosopher and an American revivalist, he was a Congregationalist, and he came up with the idea of a tapestry. Everybody, every thought, every idea, everything is like a big tapestry. And God doesn't know what you are going to do until you poke your head up and accept it. But he knows the whole tapestry. That was his explanation of how God knows everything. So you know God knows every possibility that can ever exist, but you have the choice and you occupy that spot until you pass and someone else occupies it or something close to it. So the tapestry of life, I think he called it or something. And I kind of accept that as being showing the interconnectedness of all of us. We can be in that or that tapestry. You can be way over there and way over here, but you're still on the tapestry of life. You're still connected. Extreme thought, as much as you want to say that the polarity in which we are living in our system of government, they're still connected. You start coming together, they're connected. We are all connected. All thought is connected in some way. It may be extreme opposites, but it's still connected. We are connected by a spirit. The only thing I will say about interconnectedness, I don't think the Bible supports the idea that the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil are connected. That is not connected. And so the way we access the tree of life is that through our spiritual life. That's why I think sometimes it's so hard to have a spiritual life. You know, we want to do these things, but yet we just can't quite get them done. We live in this knowledge of good and evil, but yet our spiritual life is here, and we're trying to live something that is very hard to do. But I don't think these two trees are connected in the way that we want to think. Educators give their students power. I've said that. I think that's, and even individuals, I don't think you have to be an educator. You don't have to be somebody smart to trying to teach somebody else. Just two people meeting together and having a very small conversation, something happens. I don't care. Even if you have a small conversation for a few minutes, there's an interactive and an exchange of something. Maybe we don't even know what it is. There's a lot of times I don't know what it is, but there's something that happens when two people come together. Relationships, even for a second. You bump into somebody, something happens. We are connected. Proverbs 3, 4, and 5 says that we are not to lean on our own understanding. We are to rely on God and the Lord. I should have marked it. I forgot to look it up to see where it was at. Proverbs 3, 4, and 5, you can read it. Again, we're not autonomous beings that we can think things through far enough that we can trust our own understanding to be absolutely right. I think that's what we're supposed to trust the Spirit to guide us. We are to listen. For me, listening, even though I do things wrong, listening is a very big part of my life. Do I always get it right? No. I guess it all depends. I knew that would get her going. Just because I don't agree with you does not mean I'm not listening. Well, that's in my physical reality. I'm too much over here listening to things. you're talking about my physical ears. They were half deaf when I was born. I have selective hearing. You know, when I'm over here thinking about something way out here, somewhere out here, or whatever, and somebody says something to you, you automatically go, huh? Because your mind has to travel back to where reality. And that takes a little bit, for me, it takes a little bit of time. I mean, sometimes it's a little more than others. I'm not sitting there waiting for Colleen to say something to me. What's she going to say next? What's she going to say next? So you know, I think that's what happened. There's a time lapse in between in your mind, and that's what happens. That's my excuse anyway. And I'll stick to it. But I think what excuse me. I think what the disciples were supposed to do was to listen to the Spirit. Now, the idea of that, where one can shake one's shoes off, the dust off their shoes, as a way of I never really quite understood that, why Jesus said to his disciples to shake their shoes off as a mark of, the, you know, I'm done with you, forget you. It was kind of a custom in the old days. We don't do that anymore. We probably have different ways to do it. We just come right out and say it. Yes,
Jean. Again, the modern language translation says, and whatever community will neither receive you nor listen to you, when you leave there, shake off the dust from under your feet for a witness against them.
It was a custom, I think. Do you want to add anything, Shane?
I don't remember a lot of it. I just remember that it was common, a way of insulting people.
Yeah.
Off.
Now we just curse at them.
Similar to a witness against them. That's verse 11.
You just want to leave their bad vibes there.
So it's a way of cutting off that connection with that person so it doesn't influence you.
Oh, and the Living Bible says, whenever a village won't accept you or listen to you, shake off the dust from your feet as you leave. It is a sign that you have abandoned it to its fate.
Yes, but the problem I have with it, for the love of Christ, do we do that to people? Do we at some point give up on them? That's a form of, I give up on you. You're it's in God's hands. I don't want nothing more to do with you. I don't know if that's really a Christ principle that we should apply. And that's the problem I have with the idea of shaking your dust. And Lena, you're saying the same thing. I've always had a difficulty with why Jesus told him to do that, to apply that principle. Because to me, it goes outside of what...
But you also, when you're spending so much time and energy, per se, with a negative person, you reach a point where you have to say, enough of this, I could be spending this time and energy on this other person.
But if I shake my feet, I don't know if this is true, if I shake my feet off to that person or that house, that means I can't go back, doesn't it?
No.
It don't?
No.
Don't know. See, I always took it as if I do that, if I perform that ritual, I didn't go back. I'm committing it to God. I'm committing it to someplace out, you know, I'm done.
You're not that energy there.
Yeah. The way I see it is basically... I've, for lack of a better word, wasted a lot of time here. I need to leave this alone and move on to try to help someone else. And at some point later on, if we meet again and the situation allows, I can try again.
I understand what you're saying, but I'm not sure that the act of doing that allows you to go back. That's the question I have. In the Jewish faith or whatever it is, does that allow them to go back again? I'm not sure about that. I understand what you're saying.
What we have to do, I think we get tied down with in the Jewish faith. A lot of things we're still tying to the Jewish faith and not into the new religion, the Christianity.
Yes, I'm not concerned whether or not, that's not going to stop me from going back just because the Jewish people believe that. I'm going to go back again, or I'm going to continue to have a discussion with that person or family or whatever. So the idea that I'm shut out because of a Jewish idea in the Old Testament, no. I'm not going to go back to the Old Testament and say, well, this gives me the right to, you know, thumb my nose at that person because they didn't listen to me. No, I'm not going to do that. That's the problem I have with, I'm not quite sure if I'm in under the Jewish law, whether or not, I'm just for information, whether or not they were allowed to go back.
Well,
But I will. I don't adhere to that. That's the problem I have with that. And I understand what you're saying. Yes. There comes a time, I think, sometimes when you say, okay, I'm going to walk away from the argument. I'm going to let it sit there. But I don't shake the shoes off. I don't do anything else. I simply walk away. Or I say... There's an interesting test, a verse in Timothy, where Paul writes that don't be quick to lay your hands on everybody else because you may get the sins or they may come back on you.
That's what I'm trying to say. It's kind of energy
attached to you or something. So you leave it there. Yes. I understand that procedure, but under Jewish law, does that allow me, not that, just for information's sake. Yes, I understand. Has anybody ever shaken their dust off their shoes? Have you? Yeah.
I was very judgmental when I was first. Yeah, there were people that didn't convert, didn't come to what I thought was the correct way of thinking and rejected me. And yes, I have. It doesn't leave a great feeling in your heart.
So did you take your shoes off and bang, 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 or did you just like kick them?
No, I symbolically brushed the dust off my shoes.
Oh, symbolically, okay. Okay. But under Jewish law, you would probably have to actually do that because they were very...
And I have also, and what I found, you know, as I look back over the situations, because you sometimes find people who get more enjoyment out of the conflict, the disagreement.
Yeah.
I do. When you reach that point where you say, okay, I'm done with this. I'm done with you. I'm moving on. Just their reaction to that, the look on their face, the way that it's like, maybe I wasn't getting everything. Maybe I was being so stubborn in my own thoughts, my own beliefs, that I was refusing to even entertain what was coming at me. Maybe I want to listen a little bit more carefully and loosen up on what I believe and listen to other things.
I have people do that to me. They say, I'm done with that conversation. I have a tendency to push people pretty far and just keep boom, 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 boom. I have some friends of mine that I can get to that point. But then I'll usually back up and come at it at a different angle. And so it's not like we're mad at each other or nothing like that. But yes, I have a friend of mine who tells me on a weekly basis, I'm done with this conversation. But yet he keeps coming back. So we start back around and we come back to it and we approach it again in a different way. And so, yes, I have had people tell me, you know, that I'm done. And but yet my mother used to, and I used to tell Colleen that I used to call her, you know, about every week, every other week in her later days of her life. And we used to talk about spiritual issues and, you know, biblical ideas and thoughts. And she would say, okay, I have enough. I don't want to hear no more. I don't want to hear no more. And then next week she'd come back and say, well, what did you say last week? And she would go on. And that's how we had our conversation. So, you know, I wouldn't shake my shoes off to her. I would just say, okay, that's fine. That's, you know, we'll continue on. That's the problem I have with doing this, because we're supposed to be forgiving and we're supposed to be, you know, loving. And this particular procedure does not necessarily show that in the way I think Christ would want. Yeah, I learned. I back up and I soften the argument a little bit, I approach it differently, and it usually has to do with political issues. And
no, but I mean, you're doing it to somebody else.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm done.
Yeah.
They get thinking about it and they want to come back and say, hey, you know what? I was wrong, or I'm sorry, or let's try again.
I think sometimes it's a pause. That they've gone as far as they can think, and they want to pause, so they say, okay, I'm done. But yet they're not really mad at you. They just want to pause and stop.
But you know, it teaches them something like, you know, I can't get away with doing this to this person anymore. You know, because like you said, some people I think thrive off of doing that. Just
yeah.
To get you.
I've been known to push people buttons. But, you know, I try to at least be able to say, okay. I know when to stop and back up and approach it differently. I am an argumentative person. I love a good discussion and a good debate. I'll go on for who knows how long. I am that person. And so.
But you're not mean about it. That's what I'm saying. You're not, you know.
Well, I'm glad you see that. I don't try to be mean.
You're not mean. You just frustrate people. It's just like, get away.
But didn't the disciples do that also? Didn't Paul do that also? Frustrate people? Come on, he argued and debated. And we in the Christian faith think that argument is a bad word. It's not. Argument is in the Bible.
I'm trying to remember the verse. I can't remember it. One knife sharpens the other, or one steel.
Yeah, steel against steel or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't remember the verse.
And that's what good debate and good argument is. It's we both are sharpened in the whole process. And so we in our Christian faith don't seem to want to argue. That part of it, it seems to be like, oh, don't want to argue. And yes. Yeah.
Where if you use the term debate in that context, you know, that we're debating the things, it's more of a bringing together of minds. I think it's the way we think of things now.
We want to be politically correct?
Well, not politically. I don't think that's the way, but
yeah.
So many times we think of arguments in bad terms.
Yeah, we do. We see argument, the word argument, as a bad negative term. And I don't think that word deserves that. Nothing I enjoy more than a very passionate argument or discussion or debate or whatever. I mean, I'll be the first to tell you.
It depends on what you're arguing about.
Spiritual, political, what don't matter. Yeah, I, on that level, yes, I'm very, you know.
I mean, it's tyranny.
When a discussion or an argument comes down to where you're impugning the character of the individual, no, you've done lost the argument. That's what I tell people. If you're going to tell me what I am, you've done lost the argument. And if I have to get to that level where I have to impugn somebody's character in order to win the argument, I've lost. I might as well just quit. And I try very hard not to do that. I stick to the subject matter. And I don't want to judge you for thinking that you what you think. But I am willing to debate you and carry you along the way. Let's see how far this idea goes. I love to do that. And sometimes I think I frustrate people because they don't want to go that way. Or they think of themselves.
Think about it too. You know, they're not always thinking about this stuff all the time.
But I think they think that when they get to the point where they can't go no further, that I'm challenging them and trying to tell them they're wrong. And so rather than admitting they don't know, then they go off. I think that happens sometimes too. But I think debate and argument should be in the Christian faith. We should be arguing and debating ideas and looking at new ideas and new understandings of the Bible. And it's not about everybody agreeing. It's
they argue.
Yeah.
But
they weren't Christians.
They weren't Christians. That doesn't matter.
I know. But Paul argued a lot. I mean, he went up on Mars Hill and argued. I mean, he argued and debated the validity of the Christian faith all the time. I mean, that's what he did. He went into these towns and cities, and I think that's what the disciples did. They had to present an argument for Christ and for something different that a higher understanding of truth and presenting it to the people. They had to do this. And I'm sure they bumped up against old philosophies and from the Greek to the Jews. I mean, that argument has been going on for, you know, probably started right from the very beginning. Christianity had argument and debate, and we're still not on the same page, which is a wonderful thing, I think. I think that we can. I think, anybody else have anything else you want to say? I'm going to conclude. I think that the disciples listen to the inner voice or the inner spirit within them. And deciphering what that is along the way in our lives is difficult to do. Discernment is very very difficult to do. How do I decide if it's God speaking to me or if it's my desire or if it's a mixture? That is really, and are we supporting an idea that maybe needs to be thrown out, and we're simply forcing the Bible to support an idea that we want? It's more than just an I, it's an us. And I'll say amen to that.
here today. Thank you for your love and your mercy on us. Father, I pray that everyone who looked into their hearts and acted in the obedience of your word. We have given not to become richer, but we gave because we simply love you. Accept these offerings today, and thank you that we are good stewards over your finances. In Jesus' name, amen.